Hi, everybody. This is Kate Manchester. I'm the publisher of Edible Santa Fe and member of Edible Communities, and you're listening to the Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network today. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Hearst Ranch. If you don't know about Edible Communities, check us out online, www.ediblecommunities.com. We're a membership community of 58 publications and growing all across America, and our mission is to change the way people eat by reconnecting them to our local food shed. So in that, we all produce editorially rich, community-based local food publications in distinct culinary regions throughout the U.S. and Canada. And we connect consumers with family farmers, growers, chefs, and food artisans of all kinds. And we believe that every person has the right to affordable, fresh, healthful food on a daily basis. We're for-profit, member-driven. And the individuals who own our publications are local foods advocates and residents of the communities that they publish in. It's a business model that not only supports our values, but also preserves the integrity of our member publications and the communities that we serve. So I'd like to welcome you to today's show. It is August 3rd, and I have a terrific show today. I have one guest, but I think he warrants pretty much the whole show. His name is Will Allen, and he's the CEO of Growing Power, and I'm going to tell you just a bit more about him in a minute. I'd like to talk a little bit about my vacation. I am from Rhode Island originally. I live in Santa Fe now, but last week I was on vacation in Rhode Island where I grew up. And my brother is a commercial fisherman, and every time I go to Rhode Island, I am really anxious to eat all of the seafood I can because I miss it so much, because I don't get it fresh here. It's not local here in New Mexico. So I was at home, and I was enjoying immensely eating codfish and flounder and lobsters and clams. And I started to think about whether or not it's still safe to eat all of this stuff. And I had a conversation with my brother to talk about overfishing and some of the things that are changing his livelihood and his industry. And when I got back, I did a little bit more research, and I spent some time on the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch. Monterey Bay Aquarium produces a whole segment on their website called Seafood Watch, and they talk about issues and all about the fishing practices worldwide that are damaging our oceans and depleting our fish populations and destroying habitats and polluting water and among other things. And it's really discouraging to find out that actually the cod and the flounder that I was eating were actually on the endangered list and recommended that you not eat Atlantic cod and Atlantic flounder. And the great thing about Seafood Watch is that it gives you alternatives to all of these seafoods that you might be buying. For example, a lot of us eat salmon, and it talks a lot about, there's an A to Z seafood search on there, and you can take a look at salmon, for example, and it will tell you the best choices. So the best choice would be coho, sockeye, king, pink, red, sake, caught in Alaska, and wild caught. It tells you to avoid, on their list, they say avoid farmed salmon, Atlantic salmon, sake, where caught worldwide but farmed. They tell you a better choice for salmon roe, for example, is ikura or roe caught in Alaska, wild caught, and to avoid things like farmed salmon roe, no matter where it's produced. So it'll tell you, it gives you all kinds of great information about why it's the best choice, about how it's procured, about how it's managed, by the fisheries and by the fishermen. It'll tell you, how much is ostensibly left. It's a great resource, and since so many of us are eating seafood and traveling this summer, again, I highly recommend. It's www.montereybayaquarium.org, and then go to their Seafood Watch page and learn a little bit more about what you're eating. And, if you're accustomed to eating something, whether or not it's a good choice and whether or not there are better choices out there. Another thing that I wanted to tell my listeners about this week is cooking up a story. Cooking up a story is a great little video. You can go to cookingupastory.com. And they've got videos with all kinds of people talking about all kinds of issues around food. And there's a three-part series of interviews with Dr. Vandana Shiva about the future of food. And it's one of the most revolutionary, profound, and important discussions of any that I have ever heard. And I really encourage you to visit Cooking Up a Story and listen. It's cookingupastory.com. And in case you don't know who Dr. Shiva is, she is an extraordinary woman who's devoted her life to fighting for the rights of ordinary people in India. She's a world-renowned environmental leader and thinker. And before she became an activist, she was one of India's leading physicists. So this lady is no slouch. I mean, she's got a master's degree in the philosophy of science and a PhD in particle physics. She's the director of the Research Foundation on Science, Technology, and Ecology. She's the author of many, many books. She won the Alternative Nobel Peace Prize, which is called the Right Livelihood Award. She's the founder of Navdanya, which means nine seeds. And you can go to Navdanya, I'm not sure if it's .org or .com, but it's a movement promoting diversity and use of native seeds. She's also set up the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Ecology in her mother's cowshed in 1997. So some of their studies have validated the ecological value of traditional farming. They've been instrumental in fighting destructive development projects in India and throughout the world. So she's a physicist, a scientist by training, but a social activist, environmentalist who believes in ecological sustainability, in preserving biodiversity in particular, and internationally recognized leader in the sustainable food movement. So I encourage you to check out Cooking Up a Story and watch this three-part series with Dr. Shiva. She's got very strong views about the problems of hunger in the developing world, the struggle of farmers in India, biotechnology, and she also has a prescription for the type of farming model that she believes the world needs, and she's actually somebody that we might want to really listen to. In the first part, she talks about the science of biotechnology and genetic engineering, which is great for all of us to understand, given that so many of the products on the shelves are genetically engineered, and it poses certain dangers. And again, she's really an expert and someone to listen to. It's also August 2nd through 8th marks National Farmers Market Week, and it's a week that our Agriculture Secretary, Tom Vilsack of the USDA, has designated to encourage consumers to visit their local farmers markets. This year, the USDA, in cooperation with the Farmers Market Coalition, which is farmersmarketcoalition.org, launched a special Markets Are Up campaign to help farmers markets and Farmers Markets Association communicate the vital role that these markets play in improving consumer health, local communities, and economies. So there are all kinds of resources and materials that you can find on your local farmers markets for this week. And let's see, I think the USDA estimates there are now almost 5,000 farmers markets through the U.S. 3 million consumers shop there, and they're buying fresh fruits and vegetables grown by 60,000 farmers. So these markets generate more than $1 billion in consumer spending, and those are spent in your local community. So if you've got a farmer's market and you haven't been there yet this summer, I urge you to get out there. All kinds of web resources with recipes, and farmers very often themselves have recipes for something that might be unfamiliar, but get out there and taste the bounty in your own backyard. And don't forget to vote for your favorite local farmer's market in the care2.com and at localharvest.org. Love Your Farmers Market Contest. So take a visit to care2.org. In your spare time, if you've got some time, take a look at cookingupastory.com and do the three-part. There's going to be lots of things on that website that you're going to want to look at, but definitely it's worth the time watching the three-part Vandana Shiva interview. And as for seafood, visit MontereyBayAquarium.org and look at their Seafood Watch page. So let's talk about my guest today. Will Allen. Will Allen is a visionary, and Will Allen knows farming. He started as the youngest of six children of a South Carolina sharecropper, and he learned the dawn-to-dusk routine of working the land from the time he was a young man, very young man. And today, after successful careers in professional basketball and corporate marketing, he's a farmer again, but very different kind of farmer. He's applied a lifetime of knowledge to the problems of urban poverty and malnutrition. And with the founding of Growing Power, Milwaukee's only urban farm, he's created an international model for intensive urban agriculture and community food systems. He trains people to farm. Thousands of people of all ages and backgrounds have come to learn how to create their own community food centers and to provide food security to those who have limited access to fresh foods in their own communities. He's received a $100,000 Ford Foundation Leadership Grant. In 2008, he received the MacArthur Foundation honored Growing Power with a $500,000 Genius Award. And in May of this year, the Kellogg Foundation gave Allen $400,000 to create jobs in urban agriculture. His Growing Power organization has 6 greenhouses, 8 hoop houses for herbs, greens, vegetables. He's got goats, ducks, turkeys, chickens, beehives, a system for raising tilapia and perch. He has an advanced composting operation, virtual worm farm, and a lab that's working on ways to turn food waste into fertilizer and methane gas for energy. He's got about 3 dozen full-time workers, 2,000 residents pitching in as volunteers, and his operation raises about $500,000 worth of affordable produce, meat, fish for one of what he calls the largest food deserts in American cities. So we are going to take a very short break, and we're going to come back and have a conversation with Will Allen. So I do hope that you'll join us. And we're being sponsored today by Hearst Ranch, so we'd like to thank them for this opportunity. Edible Communities on Heritage Radio Network, and we are back with Will Allen. Hi, Will.
Hello, how are you?
I'm well. How are you? I just gave you a very long intro. I don't know if you heard it or not, but...
No, I didn't.
Okay, so I just gave you a very long intro about the kind of work that you're doing, and I kind of wanted to start with a question about how you got started, because from what I understand, you were a professional athlete. Is that true?
Yes, I was. Long time ago.
Long time ago. So how did you make the switch from, a professional athlete to urban farming? What were the seeds, or what happened to kind of guide you in this direction and lead you to this work?
Well, I actually grew up on a farm right outside of Washington, D.C., on the border of Bethesda in Rockville, Maryland. I'm the son of a former sharecropper who moved to the D.C. area in the 30s. So, of course, my father brought all those farming skills. And unlike many African American sharecroppers, for some reason, he wanted myself and my brothers to learn about how food was grown. So instead of just saying, I want to get away from this kind of repressive kind of lifestyle, he wanted us to learn about the food system, I guess.
Right.
And that's how I got. I had been doing this work since very, very young age.
Now, you're doing this urban farming. I have to say, too, it's not, I really want people to understand, And I really want to paint a picture for them of what you're doing, because when I first learned about what you're doing, I got so excited, and I thought, this is something that could work in every city in America. And we, here in New Mexico, have many food deserts. They happen to be rural food deserts, but I believe that yours is a model that could work in any community in America and beyond. And we are talking about urban, intensive urban farming. So we're not talking that you live in a, you know, you don't live in a big rural area with acres and acres. How much space do you actually have for what you're producing right now?
Well, we currently have 8 farms. Of course, they're all small. The largest farm is a rural farm about 30 minutes outside of the city. But our home base is 3 acres, about 2 acres of actual production and 14 greenhouses. So we grow very intensively, and of course, to do this, there's this vertical process that we use, and which is really to engage the community as the first step. If you're not able to do that inside cities, you really can't move forward. So that's the first thing we had to do many years ago, is to get the community on board. And
Will, how did you do that?
Well, you know, I bought this last remaining farm in the city of Milwaukee for selfish reasons, really, to sell my farm produce. I farm about 100 acres outside of the city, and in 1993, I bought the last remaining farm, and about 2 years into the project, I helped a youth group who wanted to grow an organic garden, and nobody would help them, and I helped them, and we got to make a long story short, we got a front page story in the Milwaukee Journal, and I started getting calls from other schools and other nonprofits for me to help the kids. So that's how I got sucked into this work that I do today. It was working with youth. So I think the fastest way is always to engage youth in a community, and with that, you're able to get the adults on board, because this really has to be a multi. Generational, multicultural work in these communities that we live in.
Can you tell us, so you just talked about how much you've got there, and when you talk about the vertical process, are you talking about a philosophy, or are you talking about a physical process? I'm not sure what you mean when you
really
say.
Well, it's really about physical process in terms of, once you engage the community, you're going to have to grow soil, because that's what it's all about. It's like if you talk to any farmer who raises animals, it's like they'll tell you that, you know, growing grass is what they do. And when you're growing vegetables, it's all about the soil. So because our soil is contaminated not only in urban areas but in suburban areas and rural areas because of the type of industrial farming we've done. So the next thing in this vertical process is to grow soil. So we grow thousands and thousands of yards of compost, developing relationships with folks that have the waste inside the city where there's lots and lots of waste. And we're able to take carbon and nitrogen and grow compost, and then with our 5,000 pounds of worms, we feed some of that compost to the worms, and they create a fertilizer called worm castings that you need in this process. So it's really, you can't grow in the existing soil, so you have to grow all new soil. And that's something that we've been doing for a long time, and we train people around the country and around the world how to do that.
Which is fantastic. I mean, given the state of the soil, and I don't think that people realize how important the soil is, and how important it is for the nutrition of the food to have good soil. But even to be able to grow it, you can't grow anything if your soil is depleted. So this is a first step. Now, you've also got. I'd like you to paint a picture of us of your operation, and let's kind of go towards how much food you're providing and the kinds of food that you're providing in this urban, it's an urban food desert. I mean, basically where you are in Milwaukee, I was reading you know, the nearest grocery store is 3 to 5 miles away, and just for people that don't understand what a food desert is, here in New Mexico, a food desert is defined by if a supermarket is more than 25 miles, and there are plenty of food deserts around, and most of these food deserts are populated by things like liquor stores and convenience stores where fast food only is sold. So there's no real access to fresh food. And in an urban setting, a lot of times, even if it's only 3 to 5 miles away, people may not have the wherewithal to either walk or to carry fresh food that distance. Am I correct in that?
Yeah. To really paint the picture of where we are, we're on the northwest side of Milwaukee. We're 5 blocks away from the largest public housing project. If we weren't here, you'd have to travel about 4 miles either way on Silver Spring to get to a retail grocery store. Otherwise, folks are kind of stuck with either buying fast food or going to a corner store where there aren't any vegetables. So that's what I would define as, and like you said, without, you know, a car, you would have to, you know, go 4 or 5 miles and take groceries back on a bus or whatever to get them back. And especially in the wintertime, in the harsh winters that we have here, people are pretty much trapped in these communities. So it's really important to be able to have a place that they can come to and get healthy, safe, affordable food. So that's what, in our system that we have here, you can pretty much, we have a very integrated food system that we grow a lot of food. We operate a co-op of 300 farmers, so we have lots of meat on hand, grass-fed meat, only grass-fed meat. We have fish because we raise tilapia and yellow perch at our facility. And we grow year-round, which not too many people are
doing. You grow year-round because you've got the greenhouses, and is that right?
Yeah, and we use some renewable energy to be able to keep the cost down.
Uh-huh.
And some techniques using compost to heat some of the greenhouses, some of the hoop houses. We use compost to actually heat those to grow some of the greens that we grow, things like spinach, winter hardy type greens. It really makes food accessible to folks in this community. We have thousands of people that now have access to this good food that we have.
And how does it work? You've got I read somewhere that you've got somewhere along the line of 2,000 residents that pitch in as volunteers.
Yeah, I mean, this been doing this for a long time, and this work is, I always tell people it's about customer service and building relationships, because it's really important, this new kind of agriculture. It's really about working together, really engaging a lot of different folks from the community. It's really about developing those relationships. We have over 2,000 volunteers that come here from all the universities, from Marquette University, University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, MSOE. We have all these students that volunteer to come here, many of the high school students that have to do their service learning outside of the campus come here. So we're able to engage a lot of different folks that help in this communal type effort. People really care about making sure that they have a healthy food system.
Now, do you have, how do you distribute the food? Do you have a retail store?
Yeah, we have a retail store, but we have a very diversified marketing scheme. I've been at this in Milwaukee for over 33 years from my farm, so I already was marketing food into Milwaukee years ago. But now we are into the school system here. We're into corporate companies. Of course, we the main thing is to make sure that the community gets food. Restaurants here and in Chicago, where we have four farms in Illinois, we have a warehouse where all the food comes in from our other farmers that are in our co-op. So we're able to distribute that food in many ways. We have a CSA-type program called Market Basket, where we can drop food in any community at different drop sites in some of the poorest communities in Milwaukee and in Chicago. Because one of the things that I figured out a long time ago, when you're dealing with these communities, you always have social service organizations in those communities. And those social service organizations can be used as drop sites. So we partner with those organizations and drop the food there, and they're able to distribute it. We also have schools that are drop sites for our market baskets. Hmm. So we're able to do this throughout the year. We do it 52 weeks a year. We're able to get our market baskets into those food desert areas.
Hey, Will, this is Jack, the producer of the show. We actually just got a live call and question. Can you hear me right now?
Sure.
Great. So John from New York called, and he wants to know where an urban farmer can start with livestock.
Well, that's something that's happening all over the country right now. Of course, we're grandfathered to be able to have livestock. We have 37 goats. We have a couple hundred ducks, Muscovy ducks. We have 300 chickens here at our facility on these 3 acres. And we have turkeys. We're breeding heirloom turkeys. But I think you have to look at your city policies. There's a big movement to have chickens across the country, a big movement because it's been successfully done. They're doing it in Madison, Wisconsin. We have an ordinance here that should pass in Milwaukee, and there are several other cities where you can have up to four layers per family. So I think it's starting to happen. Of course, we have to be really smart about doing it, because if you cause a nuisance, you know, that's one of the things that we have to overcome, because there's definitely some people that definitely wouldn't like us to have animals. But again, if you do your work and get engaged with the community and get looked at as an asset to the community and working with youth, it's possible in cities, but I know there's huge movement toward that, because there are a lot of examples where it's being done successfully.
I also know you can go to, I think it's urbanchicken.com, because I actually just went on an urban coop tour down in Albuquerque a couple of weeks ago, and I was amazed at people's chicken coops and how creative they've gotten. But it's true, a lot of cities do have ordinances, and you know, people sometimes, very often, are allowed to have just a few chickens in the backyard. I mean, I think that if you wanted to raise, you know, turkeys or goats and things like that, you might have to have a place in the city. But Will, I agree with you. I think that, you know, if this is a movement in the direction of, you know, for the greater good of the community, there are all kinds of abandoned sites in cities that might be used, and particularly if you get a group behind you. And Will, that brings me to another question. Do you have a template for what you're doing? Because when I look at what you're doing, I'm thinking this could be done in every community in America.
Well, we have national trainings. They start in January through June, weekend trainings that folks come from all over the world to our facility to do hands-on trainings on about 7 or 8 different things, from aquaponics, raising fish and plants in the same system, to marketing, how to grow sprouts, and turnover sprouts in 1 week is a very profitable thing. To beekeeping, to greenhouse construction, composting and vermicomposting and building raised beds, something that I teach, of course. This is a way for people to learn. This is a way for people to get connected with each other that are doing similar work around their country. But one of the things that we started to do a couple of years ago is these outreach training centers around the country.
Mm-hmm.
And we have several around the country where we go out and do trainings with other organizations in strategic areas around the country. And that's listed on our website, how to become what we call a ROT, ROTC, a Regional Outreach Training Center.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have certain criteria to be able to become one, and we work with those groups over a five-year period to help them develop their infrastructure and so that they can train folks in their regional area, which is a much more effective way of doing it on a local, because this new food system, it definitely has to be local.
Right.
People have to make it work in their cultures that they're involved in. Every community has a certain culture, so it doesn't necessarily have to be done the same way we do it in Milwaukee. I never tell people to try to replicate exactly the way that we do it in Milwaukee. They need to make it work for their community, and that's very important. And we have to do this in a very multicultural, multi-generational way. So all of the work that we do is around social justice or food justice to make sure that everybody has access. Our ultimate goal is to make sure that everybody has access to the same healthy, good food is what our ultimate goal is.
Mm-hmm. I was actually reading your blog, and you were talking about our broken food system. And the fact that we've begun to see the results of the systemic breakdown and, you know, the foodborne illnesses. And I guess what I got out of that is that you said that many of your acquaintances tend to point the finger at the big agrochemical conglomerates as villains, and the fault really is with all of us who casually, willingly, even happily surrendered our rights to safe, wholesome, affordable, and plentiful foods in exchange for overprocessed and prepackaged convenience. And I think a lot of what you're talking about has to do with personal responsibility, but also taking responsibility within our own communities. And
yeah, I really believe that, we frame this thing and talked about it and blame. We tend to just spend all of our energy on blaming somebody, whether it was Earl Butz, who told all the farmers back in the early 60s to grow corn and soybeans fence row to fence row, and they would all go to glory. Well, we have a million less farmers today, and the food system's
right
in the shape that it's in. So it's easy to pick out somebody and blame the big three and so forth. But I think we're in a period now where we really have to quit doing that and spend our energy and really go into action. I mean, that's what we, I wouldn't do this work if I just sat around and talked about it. It's really about going out and building those relationships and quickly and getting something going, whether it's perfect or not, but do something.
Get started.
Get off the planning table. Get out and get something started in these communities. Get the people engaged. Even if it's a small thing, mm-hmm. Just do something. So I think as we stand today, this good food movement has gone to another phase. I now call it the good food revolution. I think we're at that stage where this is really a revolution. And a lot of people want to join, even the top-down operators such as corporate companies and universities and politicos. They all want to join a grassroots effort, something that was born through many years, and now all these top, everybody wants it. It's a mainstream kind of phenomena right now, and this is a time for us to really start taking some action instead of just blaming people, because that takes too much energy. To do this work, you need lots and lots of energy.
Lots of energy, and lots of physical energy, too, as you well know. This is another thing that I think that people, it's actually a great gift for people to realize that, that carrots don't come in cellophane packages, and that it actually grows in the earth, and it takes some work to get there, and it's actually a really satisfying process.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, and some of the misconceptions, like kids don't know what good food is. Of course they do. If you ask any kid, if you talk to any kid, have you ever had, tell me about a good meal you had. They'll talk about when they go to grandma's house for Thanksgiving or Christmas or the holidays. It's all about access. So we need to make sure that these kids have access to food. We need to make sure everybody has access. And we have all this vacant land inside cities and vacant buildings that we could be growing food or growing fish or whatever. So growing food locally inside cities is definitely a doable thing because we're doing it.
Hey, Will, I'm sorry. This is Jack again, the producer. We had another call in, actually, Tim from Connecticut. He wants to know how much of the population can urban farming actually feed? And if you include suburban farming, would that cover the entire country?
Okay, I can give you my estimates. I think we need to fundamentally change the existing food system that we have, the bad food system that we have, GMO foods that we're all eating and not even knowing we're eating them. We need about 50 million new people growing food in local communities. And I'm not talking about 50 million farmers. I'm talking about 50 million people growing in their backyard, side yards, on containers, on their back porches, wherever they can grow food, in community gardens and community farms. Then we can start seeing a real change, because less than 1% of the food that's sold in the city of Milwaukee, we can take Milwaukee, but almost every city's like this, Cleveland or Detroit or whatever, less than 1% is locally grown. So just imagine if we're able to, in the next 5 years, go from 1% to 10%, how many jobs could be created? What the environmental impact would have with 10% less trucks coming from Salinas Valley to the Midwest or to New York or Philadelphia or whatever. So it's really about growing the system. Right now, everybody is really inspired to want to do something. We have to really take many of these youth programs, because there are hundreds of them. In our cities, hundreds of youth programs this summer growing food. We must ramp up the production. Is what we have to do to really make these changes to get that 1% to 10% over the next 5 years. And I think we can do it. I know we can do it.
I agree. And years ago, I did an interview with Dr. Derek Depomier. And he does this whole program on vertical farming, or Dixon Depomier, that's what his name was, Dixon Depomier. And he's a professor, gosh, I'm going to have to remember where he teaches, but he said that by the year 2050, nearly 80% of the Earth's population will reside in urban centers. And you know, the human population will increase by about 3 billion people during, you know, between now and then. And he said that an estimated 109 hectares of new land, so 20% more land than is represented by the country of Brazil, will be needed to grow enough food to feed these people if traditional farming practices are continued as they are practiced today. So 80% of the land that's suitable for raising crops is already in use by something, you know, it's already in use. So, you know, 15% of that has been laid to waste by poor management practices.
Right.
So I think that urban farming farming across the land is important, but particularly in urban centers, given where we're headed. And how many people are you feeding right now?
To really have a sustainable, it's my belief, to have a sustainable food system that everybody wants, we really have to have a combination of urban farming and rural farming. We can't just say, hey, we're going to all of a sudden do urban farming and forget about rural America. We need to reinstate and help those mid-sized farmers that are struggling. Those are the farmers that have always fed America, and those are the farmers that need help. And we need to develop this urban landscape, because it is a reality that today more people live in cities or close to cities than in rural areas worldwide. So we really have a problem on our hands in terms of, as we speak, we're losing farmland
right.
to development and other things. So we really have to think about growing food in places more intensively to be able to figure out how do we grow food with less space.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do we go from, less than a dollar per square feet of production to $30 a square foot or something like that.
Now, one of the things that I want to, again, if a lot of people are not on the web or can't see, you are growing in your greenhouse. You also have an aquaculture center. Is that true? You're doing fish there also.
Yeah, we're growing fish. We've dug out trenches below ground, so you have production on five different levels. We're able to take, say, 3,000 square feet of greenhouse space, and by using vertical growing inside a greenhouse, we're able to take that 3,000 square feet and turn it into 5,000 square feet. So those are the types of things that we need to do. We need to use renewable energy. We've developed a high-solid anaerobic digester. We use compost to heat our hoop houses. We're using geothermal. We're using solar. So all of those things have to come into play in the future. So that's part of this kind of new type of farming that's viable now and into the future. So we're really looking into the future. And our next generation of farmers will not come from rural America, but they'll come from urban America. And they'll
right.
come out of our universities and from everywhere. So we're really training this new generation of farmers, starting with, all these farm-to-school projects and young people learning how to grow food at a very early age. So a lot of good things are happening. I think it's a revolution now.
I think it's a revolution,
unlike
too.
Unlike what Nikki Giovanni said about this revolution will not be televised. We need to televise and radioize this revolution, because people need to get to understand what it is and to get on board and to volunteer participate in it, because it's a responsibility of all of us to make sure that we have food for the future. Otherwise, we're going to be in really bad shape.
Dire straits. Will, are there other cities where that you guys are working in or have worked with people in other cities with successful projects?
Yeah, there is successful projects all over the country. We're working in Louisville, Kentucky, with Breaking New Grounds. We're working in Mississippi Delta with Mega. We're working in Arkansas. We're working in Cleveland, as a matter of fact, Botanical Gardens, who has a very strong youth program they were visiting today. We're working with groups all over the country and engaging groups in training. We trained literally thousands of people over the years that have come to our workshops that are now starting projects. We just have to ramp up the production and get more people on board, and they're coming on board. One of the things that we really need is, I was kind of disappointed, is not very much stimulus dollars were targeted for agriculture, whether it was rural agriculture or urban agriculture. And so we're still fighting to get some funding into the system so that we can create jobs. Because I think as we develop this new, smaller scale, more communal, more participatory agriculture, we're going to be able to create thousands of jobs. But we need a little bit of assistance, and that's what we're going to have to fight for now and in the next farm bill.
Right.
To make sure that we're getting healthy food into our school systems. Here in Milwaukee, we're very fortunate to have a mayor, and we have a governor, and both of our senators, Senator Cole and Feingold, that support what we're doing here. But that doesn't happen overnight. I think what has helped is having a concrete project that they can come and see that this is possible, that you can do this type of agriculture, and that it makes sense, that it's an asset to the community, because if they look at it as an asset to the community, politicos are more likely to support it. But they have to have something to see. We can't just go there and say, oh, we want to do this. We have to have some concrete evidence that this works.
Well, it's like anything else. I mean, I think you have to be smart about it. I think you have to have a plan. I think you have to have, you know, manpower and community partners, you know, partnerships. Of course, it always helps to get some money, you know, from funders, and I know that you've been very fortunate. But all of that came, what came before that was a lot of blood and sweat and tears and hard work to get the, to get what you have in place. And then people begin to recognize and begin to see. And that's why I'm so interested in what you're doing as a template, you know, as a template and as a resource for other communities. Because, you know, people like you are out there doing the hard work and creating something that actually does work and that actually does, you know, it's economically viable. It feeds people. I mean, I think you're feeding 10,000 people in Milwaukee right now.
Yeah, we have quantified our what we're doing. We feed over 10,000 people, and that's kind of a low estimate. But we need hundreds of places just like what we have, hundreds of around the country to be able to replicate this in that kind of way. Again, we have 35 employees that get paid living wage jobs. That's one of the principles that we live by, a growing power, because it just doesn't work. I wouldn't do this work if we weren't able to do that. So that's very important.
Right.
We've never laid off a person in the 16 years that I've been doing this work. So it's very important to make sure we have sustainable jobs so that people have a chance to become passionate about the work that they do, and they can go out and do the work. And feel good about doing the work and enjoy doing the work. So that's very important, because I just think that this is a great opportunity for us. We have leadership at the White House in terms of the White House garden. I don't think we've had any better time to really grow this revolution than we do right now.
So if people want more information and want to look at what you've created, they should go to growingpower, it's growingpower.org, and you've got all kinds of resources on your website, Will. Under, you've got Home, About Us, Farms Grow, Bloom, Thrive, and you've got tours. There are ways to volunteer. There are workshops. There are internships. There's youth education, outreach projects, food policy, growing food injustice.
Yeah, and that's very important. We have an upcoming, which will be our fifth national conference in the last 5 years here in Milwaukee, and it's Growing Food Injustice. It's a national movement of folks, about 500 folks and organizations that we house at Growing Power, to dismantle racism in the food system, to make sure that redlining of communities where grocery stores don't seem to want to build inns and many other things around the food system. So we have a national gathering that starts on the 30th of October. The day before that, we'll have a national hands-on training at Growing Power. So there's an opportunity for folks to come in and get a full day of hands-on training before the conference, before the gathering, and then go to the gathering on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
That's fantastic.
So that's on our website. We also have a blog and a Facebook thing, I guess. I'm kind of low tech, so these are my.
Yeah, but you know what? You're right about the revolution not being televised. It's going to be. It's going to spread through social media. So you're doing the right thing here. So you've got a blog. There are tons of resources. You've also got a page on here for your regional outreach training centers and for training for people that want to come and find out more about how to do this in their own community.
Yes. Yeah, we're pretty easy to get in touch with. Probably not me, but...
Well, I can vouch for that. I mean, when I actually called, I got Karen on the phone pretty much on day one. People actually answer the phone in your organization.
Yeah.
So under events, we've got all kinds of events happening, but the October event is listed, Growing Food and Justice for All Initiative.
Yes.
And those dates are still October 28th through November 1st?
Yes.
Okay, great.
Yes, they have an intensive training on the 28th and 29th, and we have our national training, hands-on training with, you know, learning how to compost and vermicompost and aquaponics and so forth on the 29th, and then the conference starts on the 30th. So,
this is fantastic.
You can get all that information and the cost and so forth. It's a very affordable gathering here in Milwaukee, and it's the second annual one. We had one last year with over 200 people. This year they're expecting close to 400 people. So.
Fantastic. Spread the word.
Yes.
Get more people out there doing this kind of work.
Yes.
Will, I would like to thank you for joining us today. I'm really, I'm very excited about what you're doing, and I've read something, I think it was in Yes Magazine, was it Yes Magazine? A couple of months ago, and I wound up buying about 10 copies and sending them to different people. And then when I saw you in the Times a few weeks ago, I was very excited to see, you know, to see that this kind of press talking about what you're doing, because I think it's hugely important.
Thank you.
So keep up the good work, and we here at Edible Communities, I think you're going to be hearing more from us. You know, we're really interested in what you're doing, and we can be a vehicle and a mouthpiece for that too. So we're happy to do what we can. And I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you for joining the revolution, the good food revolution.
That's right. We're part of it too. So
so let's refer to it as a good food revolution in the future.
I love it. The good food revolution. Will, thank you so much. We are going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
Thank you.
This is Kate Manchester. You're back with Edible Communities on Heritage Radio Network. That was Will Allen, ladies and gentlemen, and I do encourage you to visit Will's website and really take your time, spend some time on that website, and take a look at what he has created and what he's doing. He's clearly a very modest man. But his vision is big, and this man has been working tirelessly for years in this organization, which he's created with the help of a lot of volunteers and committed people, and he's really created a model that is replicable in pretty much any community across the country. And yes, it takes a lot of hard work, But I think that this is work worth doing. And take a look at growingpower.org and take a look at some of the things that he's doing and the numbers of people that he's feeding and the kind of space that he's doing it in. Next week, you're going to be back with, I'm not sure if it's going to be Marla Camp of Edible Austin or Deborah Shapiro of Edible Green Mountains, but they will be your hostesses. One of those fine ladies will be your hostess next week on the Edible Communities on Heritage Radio Network. And we want to thank our sponsor today. Our sponsor was Hearst Ranch, and we want to thank them for making this show possible. And if you've got questions, ideas, you know, thoughts about guests that you'd like to see on the show or hear on the show, you can email me directly, kate@ediblesantafe.com, and I'd be happy to have a conversation with you or take your suggestions or hear what you have to say. So once again, our thanks to Hearst Ranch, our thanks to Will Allen and Growing Power, and we'll be back next week with Edible Communities on Heritage Radio Network.